Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
MMH opens vaccine clinic. Midland health officials said Tuesday that its vaccination clinic at the former West Campus can accommodate around 400 people a day. Chief Operations Officer Stephen Bowerman stated Tuesday morning that 192 patients were scheduled for later in the day, and that Midland Health also would be accepting walk-ins when the schedule allows. Bowerman said the vaccination clinic will welcome those looking for a first or second vaccine or a booster shot at the F. Marie Hall Outpatient Center. Bowerman added on Tuesday that those needing Moderna shots will be able to receive one while inventory allows. Otherwise, Pfizer will be provided for first, second, or booster shots. Midland health officials recommend that people talk to their physicians if they don't know if they are eligible for a booster. Those wanting to schedule a time for a booster or a first or second shot can call 221-4VAX or go to midlandhealth.org/schedule-my-vaccine. The clinics will take place during the afternoon on Tuesday through Thursday at the F. Marie Hall Outpatient Center. Bowerman also said Tuesday that vaccine clinics held Monday provided 171 vaccines, including 88 at the YMCA and 83 at Legacy High School. Midland Health reported it provided 1,374 vaccines last week, 1,679 this month, and 2,838 in August.
Hello, this is Michael, reading articles related to the coronavirus published in the Midland and Odessa newspapers on Wednesday, September 15th, 2021. Starting with continuing in the health section of the Midland Reporter-Telegram this Wednesday. Mocking vaccine resistors is not helpful. You've likely seen the headlines about COVID-19 killing radio hosts and activists who opposed vaccines and masks. Several of those headlines were about Caleb Wallace, a Texan who helped organize a freedom rally this summer to protest mask wearing. Some corners of the internet reacted with ridicule to news of his death last month, sparing no thought to Wallace's grieving wife and daughters. It's important that we all resist the impulse to scream, "I told you so." Yes, it's maddening to find ourselves swept up in yet another wave of COVID-19 cases 8 months into the rollout of vaccines that should have ended this pandemic by now. But every death is a tragedy and should be treated as such. Mocking vaccine skeptics who have been fed misinformation won't convince people on the fence to get vaccinated. Our inclination should be to show others that we care about them, not to win an argument. Dallas County has been bombarding people with opportunities to get vaccinated. We appreciate officials' unrelenting efforts to expand access to the vaccine, but their main hurdle now is resistance to the science and to the messengers. The tone of the message matters greatly. A Census Bureau survey and polling from the Kaiser Family Foundation show that concerns about side effects or the newness of the vaccine and distrust in the government rank among the top reasons why people are hesitant to get the shots. Yes, there are relentless vaccine skeptics whose foolish actions demonstrate they're immune to reason. But the loud ones don't represent all. Sherry Mixon, executive director of the T.R. Hoover Community Development Center in South Dallas, said she's heartbroken because an unvaccinated family in her circle is both grieving a father who died from COVID-19 and watching two adult sons struggle to survive in the hospital. Mixon said people in her community can be leery when officials share information with them suddenly instead of gradually. When this pandemic hit, a lot of information didn't hit the doorsteps or mailboxes of the folks in this community, she told us. That's the reason we took charge to search the net and call different agencies and provide that information out in vaccine registration lines. The demographic groups that government officials are targeting for vaccination should be involved in crafting the message, Mixon said. Leslie Armijo, an Oak Cliff community advocate who's been promoting the vaccine all year, and said some of the reluctance among Hispanic families in this area stems from confusion about whether insurance is required and fear that personal data could be shared with immigration authorities. Having leaders from President Joe Biden to Dallas County Judge Clay Jenkins constantly assure people that this data sharing is not happening would help some families feel more comfortable, Armijo told us. When Armijo's neighbors justify their hesitancy based on myths, she said she tries to understand their feelings and share facts. It's one thing to indulge a conspiracy theory, and it's another to recognize that someone's views are wrong, but that their fears are sincere. We should learn from Armijo's approach. I also take no for an answer, she told us. It may not be that first time, or that second encounter, or the third encounter, but hopefully, if they keep having positive encounters with people who are promoting vaccines, eventually it will have some kind of effect. Guest view from the Dallas Morning News. Are there tests to measure immunity? By Lindsay Bever, Washington Post. Is there a test to measure immunity to COVID-19? That is, can we tell if the vaccine took or if we've developed natural immunity? Chad in Arizona. Yes, scientists can absolutely measure antibodies produced by the coronavirus vaccine and by natural infection from COVID-19. There are even fancy tests that researchers can use to distinguish between those produced by some vaccines and the actual virus. But because scientists are still learning about the virus, and because the immune system is such a complex machine, and antibody tests may not tell the whole story. That is, it may not show whether a person is protected or how protected that person is from the disease, said William Moss, executive director of the International Vaccine Access Center at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Here's why. First, commercial antibody tests may not be searching for the antibodies that protect against infection. Moss said many tests done in commercial laboratories measure a variety of antibodies, but not necessarily the ones that stop the virus. Neutralizing antibody tests measure the neutralizing antibodies that bind to the spike protein and block the virus from entering healthy cells, thereby keeping it from replicating in the body, he said. But he said these tests are not widely available. Second, although scientists have a clearer grasp these days of what level of immunity is protective, there is no magic number. There is a strong correlation between the levels of neutralizing antibodies and protection, but we've not yet defined a cutoff, and I'm not sure we'll be able to, Moss said. What we would like to be able to say is that antibody levels above a certain threshold are protective, and that antibody levels below a certain threshold are not protective. But biology is not that simple, he added. And in any case, antibodies are only part of it. The immune system also produces memory cells, white blood cells known as memory B cells, and protective T cells. So even when antibody levels wane over time, the immune system can still call on those memory cells to respond. B cells start making more antibodies, while T cells work to attack and kill other cells infected with the virus. So yes, you can get a blood test to see whether you have antibodies against the coronavirus, but it may not tell you much more than that. That's why the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and many medical experts agree that antibody testing is not recommended to assess immunity. Biden administration moves to stave off shortage of monoclonal antibodies. By Lenny Bernstein, Washington Post. The Biden administration moved this week to stave off a shortage of monoclonal antibodies, taking over distribution of the critical COVID-19 therapy while it tries to purchase more. The policy change that went into effect Monday is all but certain to result in cuts of the medication to some states, especially 7 in the Deep South with high infection rates that have been using about 70% of the national supply. Soaring demand for the therapy represents a sharp turn from just 2 months ago, when monoclonal antibodies were widely available and awareness of them was low. With little promotion by the government, consumers, doctors, and states were using just a tiny fraction of the available supply. Since then, however, word of the highly effective therapy, which is free to patients, has spread, with federal officials and Republican lawmakers, including Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, urging their use. Now the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, at least temporarily, set the rules for distribution of monoclonal antibodies instead of allowing states, medical facilities, and doctors to order them directly. HHS will determine the amount of product each state and territory receives on a weekly basis. State and territorial health departments will subsequently identify sites that will receive product and how much, an HHS spokesman said. He spoke on the condition of anonymity to describe new procedures that are still being explained to communities around the country. This system will help maintain equitable distribution both geographically and temporarily across the country, providing states and territories with consistent, fairly distributed supply over the coming weeks, he added. The move already has prompted concern in one state, Alabama, where the president of the state medical association, Aruna Arora, released a statement Monday saying that Alabama's hospitals are full and under tremendous stress. That's why physicians are very concerned about federal efforts that will end up limiting our supply and access to this effective treatment. Alabama, Florida, Texas, Mississippi, Tennessee, Georgia, and Louisiana, all states where vaccination rates are low and the Delta variant of the virus has been surging in recent months, have been using 70% of the monoclonal antibody supply in recent weeks, according to HHS data distributed at a meeting Friday and a person familiar with the situation. President Joe Biden vowed in a speech last week to ramp up use of COVID-19 therapeutics as part of a renewed effort to quell the pandemic in the United States. According to data from the meeting with stakeholders involved in the monoclonal antibody distribution, 2.17 million doses of the therapy have been shipped to 8,003 sites, and 938,000 have been used. The large difference may reflect a lag in reporting, according to one person tracking usage of the medication. And now the story from the Odessa American this Wednesday, September 15th. COVID cases climbing, wiping out months of progress. The Associated Press. COVID-19 deaths and cases in the U.S. have climbed back to levels not seen since last winter, erasing months of progress and potentially bolstering President Joe Biden's argument for his sweeping new vaccination requirements. The cases, driven by the Delta variant, combined with resistance among some Americans to getting the vaccine, are concentrated mostly in the South. While one-time hotspots like Florida and Louisiana are improving, infection rates are soaring in Kentucky, Georgia, and Tennessee, fueled by children now back in school, loose mask restrictions, and low vaccination levels. The dire situation in some hospitals is starting to sound like January's infection peak. Surgeries canceled in hospitals in Washington State and Utah. Severe staff shortages in Kentucky and Alabama. A lack of beds in Tennessee. Intensive care units at or over capacity in Texas. This deteriorating picture, 9 months into the nation's vaccination drive, has angered and frustrated medical professionals who see the heartbreak as preventable. The vast majority of the dead and the hospitalized have been unvaccinated, in what has proved to be a hard lesson for some families. The problem now is we have been trying to educate based on science, but I think most of the education that is happening now is based on tragedy, personal tragedy, said Dr. Ryan Stanton, an emergency room physician in Lexington, Kentucky. The U.S. is averaging over 1,800 COVID-19 deaths and 170,000 new cases per day, the highest levels respectively since early March and late January. And both figures have been on the rise over the past 2 weeks. The country is still well below the terrifying peaks reached in January, when it was averaging about 3,400 deaths and 250,000 cases per day. The U.S. is dispensing about 900,000 vaccinations per day, down from a high of 3.4 million a day in mid-April. On Friday, a Food and Drug Administration advisory panel will meet to discuss whether the U.S. should begin giving booster shots of the Pfizer vaccine. On a positive note, the number of people now in the hospital with COVID-19 appears to be leveling off or even declining at around 90,000, or about where things stood in February. But the measures aimed at containing the virus have run into opposition. Last week, a Tennessee high school student who spoke at a school board meeting in favor of a mask mandate was heckled by adults while he talked about his grandmother dying from the virus. Stanton, the ER doctor in Kentucky, said he has admitted families where the Delta variant has swept through generations, especially if the older members are unvaccinated. Now in Kentucky, one-third of new cases are under age 18, he said. Some children brought it home from summer camp and spread it to the rest of the family. And now, between daycare and schools and school activities and friends getting together, there are just so many exposures. In Hidalgo County, Texas, along the Mexican border, about 50 patients were in the hospital with COVID-19 on a given day in July. By early August, the number had soared to over 600. Back in July, we were almost celebrating. Little did we know, said Ivan Melendez, public health authority for Hidalgo County. The situation has improved, with just under 300 people in the hospital as of Monday, but ICUs are still above 90% capacity, Melendez said. The biggest surge over the summer occurred in states that had low vaccination rates, particularly in the South, where many people rely on air conditioning and breathe recirculated air, said Lenny Marr, a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Virginia Tech. She said states farther north could see upticks as the onset of cold weather sends people indoors. Vaccination rates are not as low in some northern states, but there's still a lot of unvaccinated people out there. Delta is going to find them, Marr said.
Hello, this is Cindy reading from the Odessa American for Saturday, September 11th. West Texas Food Bank to Soon Open Innovative Gardens by Michael Bauer. After numerous delays and disruptions in the construction schedule, the West Texas Food Bank will soon finally be able to cut the ribbon on its new innovative gardens at its Midland facility. The 20-acre expansion will have its ribbon-cutting ceremony at 10 a.m., September 25th, at the West Texas Food Bank's Midland location at 1601 West Cliff Drive, where children of all ages are welcome. The idea for the innovative gardens has been floating around since the Midland facility first opened a few years ago when there was a need for more parking. As we were a little landlocked, we needed parking, Director of Communications for the West Texas Food Bank Craig Stoker said. It became apparent that we didn't have enough parking as soon as we opened. It wasn't long until the idea to expand the gardens at the Midland location came about after the success of the West Texas Food Bank's greenhouses and educational programming to the community. We needed more parking, and the idea was to expand the gardens and expand the parking while we're at it, Stoker said. Thus, the Innovative Gardens project was born. The new garden will have two biodomes, and a classroom will feature many different plants and trees that do not normally grow in West Texas. Most of those plants will include banana trees and pomegranate trees, just to name a few. We'll have the biodomes that are the centerpiece of it, and that will allow us to grow tropical fruit that kids may not have seen before, Stoker said. To see the bananas grow on a tree, we're going to have citrus trees in there too. Kids might not know that a lemon comes from a tree. There will also be a garden for pollinators and a garden to showcase drought-tolerant, sun-loving plants with a bunch of vegetables. We will have raised planting beds that'll have a bunch of tomatoes and cucumbers and peppers and those things growing, Stoker said. The goal is to really show kids where food comes from, and that it's not from the back of the grocery store. There will be walking paths throughout the garden. The pollinator garden will attract bees, butterflies, and other pollinator insects to teach kids how crucial they are. If the plants don't get pollinated, we don't get tomatoes, Stoker said. You have to be aware of your environment and take care of it. The idea of putting together the innovative gardens has been in the works for about 5 years. The project was originally supposed to be completed last fall. Then came the pandemic, which forced some delays. Innovative Gardens has been such a project of emotions and creativity and challenges that we are so excited to ribbon cut this garden, West Texas Food Bank Executive Director Libby Campbell said. We're excited to let people see all the great things that we were dreaming of before COVID came during construction, which was very challenging, not just because of the need at the food bank extended everything before the pandemic and is still high today, but also just building challenges that you're hearing throughout the world right now, like getting supplies. It wasn't just the pandemic that forced some delays. The winter storm in February also brought about some challenges. While the garden will open this month, Campbell says there are still some plants that couldn't get in due to the freeze from this winter, and that has delayed some portions of the project. We're still delayed because we weren't able to plant on time, Campbell said. Not only that, when things cleared, a lot of things that should have been planted in the spring had been killed due to the freeze. So it was hard to get plants and things over the spring and summer months. We're about 8 to 9 months behind on our planting schedule, but we've been able to plant things out there and still make it a beautiful place and be able to provide education for our community and a space for people to get outside and spend time as a family, which I think is important. Fruit trees will also include apples, figs, peaches, pears, and citrus. You can grow things here in West Texas besides mesquite and oil under the ground, Campbell said. Campbell also described the classroom building at the gardens as looking similar to a chapel or a little house. It's designed like that so that if you want to grow sweet potatoes, you can grow them on the west side of your home, Campbell said. Our gardener on staff can teach the people how to do a garden and what are good things to grow here in West Texas. We've tried to grow different things that you wouldn't think would grow in West Texas, but they do. This fall, we'll be planting some trees, obviously. You'll get to see some apple trees and some pomegranate trees. There's also some things like conservation of our earth, like taking care of where we live. There'll also be a flower garden that helps Mother Nature continue to pollinate. We're excited to have that going on. The project has cost up to $1.8 million. That's, of course, with the expanded parking lot that we also added for our staff at the Midland location. To be able to do a project like this, especially during a stressful time, where a pandemic is still ongoing, Campbell says it has been impressive that the West Texas Food Bank has continued to serve the community while also being able to finish the completion of innovative gardens. We need to keep meeting the need out there, and we couldn't do that without the support of our community, Campbell said. But then as you get to look at things that we've been able to do, like meet the need of hunger, we've also been able to do what we love to do too, which is education. We've been able to bring different things to our clients and our families and communities in which we bring hope. The fact that we're able to start this project before COVID and finish it shows the turmoil that the food bank has undergone, and to still be able to bring something like this to our community really makes us feel lucky that we get to go to work here and continue to do our job and bring innovative and different things to West Texas. We couldn't do that without our support out here. If you go, Innovative Gardens Ribbon Cutting Ceremony, the West Texas Food Bank, 1601 West Cliff Drive, Midland, 10 a.m. September 25th. Online, wtx-foodbank.org. Donations needed. The Oil and Gas Workers Association has reached out to Medical Center Hospital to help with relief from Hurricane Ida, in particular, Louisiana and the Gulf Coast region. Donation barrels have been set up outside the cafeteria as well as outside of the urgent cares on West University and JBS Parkway. Donation items requested include bottled water, diapers, and non-perishable food items and canned goods. The Oil and Gas Workers Association will then take the donated items and goods directly to those affected in Louisiana and the Gulf Coast region. Ellen Noel joins Smithsonian's National Youth Summit on Gender Equity. The Ellen Noel Art Museum will participate in the National Youth Summit on Gender Equity, an online outreach program organized by the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History in partnership with Smithsonian affiliations from September 21st through October 12th. Designed for middle and high school students across the country, this year's topic will allow youth to examine gender equity and efforts to fight against gender bias. Two live events are scheduled for noon to 3 p.m. September 21st and noon to 2 p.m. October 12th. Teachers may register their classrooms for the webcast and to access free supplementary education materials for all ages at americanhistory.si.edu/NYS. Teachers may also facilitate their own youth summits any time between September 21st and October 12th using learning resources and videos provided free to all registered educators. The Ellen Noel Art Museum has chosen to focus on confronting gender bias in sports, and its regional youth summit will take place virtually September 23rd, moderated by Anna Martinez-Katsum, UTPB Professor of History. This free regional youth summit is open to middle and high school students ages 14 to 18. Participation size will be limited, and interested students are encouraged to register before September 15th. Participating students will also be given a completion certificate and a zine kit. For more information or to find out how students may register, contact Annie Stanley at education@noelartmuseum.org or 550-9696, extension 213.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter-Telegram weekend edition for Saturday, September 11th, 2021.
U.S. rig count tops 500 by Mella McEwen. Drilling activity began recovering from the efforts of Hurricane Ida, with four offshore rigs returning to work after the previous week's 13-rig decline. Combined with the addition of two land rigs, the U.S. rig count rose by six this week. That puts 503 rigs at work nationally, according to oilfield services firm Baker Hughes and data analytics firm Enverus. A year ago, there were 254 rigs at work, 249 less than this week. There were 401 rigs drilling for crude oil, up 7 for the week, and 221 more than the 180 drilling for oil last year. The number of rigs seeking natural gas fell by 1 to 101, 30 more than the 71 drilling for gas last September. Texas added 3 rigs for 235 at work statewide, 130 more than the 105 reported last year. New Mexico's rig count of 82 was unchanged for the week. Louisiana, up 4, and Utah, up 1, joined Texas as producing states with higher rig counts, while Pennsylvania was the only producing state to report a decline, down 2 rigs. The Permian Basin rig count rose by 4 to 254, 130 more than the 124 at work in the basin a year earlier. Lee County, New Mexico remains the most active in the Permian with 50 rigs, unchanged for the week. Eddy County, New Mexico follows with 30 rigs, also unchanged for the week. Midland County added a rig for 28 rigs drilling within county lines, followed by Martin County with 25, down 1. Reeves County fell 2 rigs to 21, while Howard and Loving counties each reported 16 rigs for a second week. Ector County saw its rig count double to 4 for the week. Crockett County saw renewed activity with 1 rig going to work this week. Enveris Rig Analytics reported its U.S. rig count rose 13 to 607 as of September 8th. The count is up 3% in the last month and 60% year-to-date. The largest week-over-week changes occurred in the Anadarko Basin, adding 5 to each to reach 53, and the Gulf Coast, rising by 4 to 21 to 71. While the total U.S. active rig count is 116% higher than it was a year ago, rig numbers are still 33% below this time in pre-pandemic 2019. By major play, Enveris reports, the Anadarko Basin is down 29% from 2 years ago, and Appalachia is down by 25%. The DJ Basin, which has also seen an increase in required well setbacks and a more rigorous permitting process, is down 52%. The Gulf Coast is still down 28%, and the Permian is down 38%. The Bakken, having endured an ongoing Dakota Access Pipeline saga that at points put into question whether the line's takeaway might be shut in, is off 51%.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Tuesday, September 14th. This is the business and oil page. This article is entitled, Here's Why U.S. Oil Supplies Took Such a Big Hit from Ida, by Sergio Chapa and David Weth, Bloomberg. Hurricane Ida unleashed such furious winds and waves that almost 2 weeks later, oil drillers, power suppliers, and refiners are still picking up the pieces. They won't be done anytime soon. The damage to offshore platforms, pipelines, and even helipads was so severe that 2 out of every 3 barrels of crude normally pumped from the U.S. sector of the Gulf of Mexico are unavailable. The ripple effects are still playing out as refiners and brokers scour the globe for replacements, and the Gulf's biggest oil producer, Royal Dutch Shell PLC, tells some customers it can't honor supply commitments. It will be weeks, maybe longer, before normal conditions can be restored off the Louisiana coast and in the warren of oil processing and chemical plants that occupies a 100-mile corridor from New Orleans to Baton Rouge. Recovery efforts may be hindered by Tropical Storm Nicholas, which gained power Monday as it headed toward the coast of Texas, likely bringing flooding rains to Houston and Louisiana. What's different is this is lasting longer, Bert Winders, 63, a Baker Hughes Company health and safety director, said in reference to how Ida's disruption compared with previous hurricanes. It's just demanding on people. 3 to 5 days they can deal with. But when you start talking 2, 3, even 4 weeks, that's really tough on a family. The recovery efforts are being closely watched around the world in large part because of the unprecedented scale and duration of the oil outages. Within days of the hurricane, traders were seizing on arbitrage opportunities created by the disappearance of some U.S. Gulf grades of oil, such as Mars Blend. For example, crude from Russia's Ural Mountains is a popular alternative to Mars because they share similar characteristics. Ida's drawn-out aftermath offers a chastening glimpse of what may be in store as climate change fuels even more furious storms along low-lying coastal regions dotted with heavy industry and vital fuel-making facilities. Typically, when tropical storms and hurricanes menace the oil-producing region of the Gulf, drillers batten down hatches, shut off the subsea well funneling oil up to platforms, and evacuate crews. When the skies clear, they often cut chopper inspection teams back out in a matter of hours or days and resume production shortly thereafter. When Louisiana was battered by Hurricane Laura last year, offshore crude output bounced back quickly. Direct hit. After Ida, that wasn't remotely possible. The monster storm's direct hit on Port Fourchon a few hours before sundown on August 29 completely disabled the primary jumping-off point for helicopters and vessels that service hundreds of offshore platforms and rigs. Even the lone road connecting Port Fourchon to the rest of the state, Louisiana Highway 1, was knocked out of commission by Ida's massive wall of seawater and the tons of sand it swept ahead. When Port of Fourchon is out of service, it breaks a link in the chain, said Winders, a Louisiana native who's been working in the oil industry for 4 decades. Into darkness. At the height of the disaster, more than 1 million homes and businesses were cast into darkness as Ida's 150-mile-per-hour winds destroyed most of the transmission infrastructure in southeast Louisiana. But by late Friday, there were almost 200,000 without power or air conditioning, a telling illustration of the extent of the destruction. As for Port Fourchon, the area isn't expected to get full electricity restored until the end of this month, according to the utility company Entergy Corporation. Out on the high seas, drilling has returned to just 29% of pre-Ida levels. There were 4 rigs operating in the U.S. sector of the Gulf as of Friday, well below the 14 plying the waters before the storm, according to data from Baker Hughes, which has been tracking drilling activity since 1944. Hobbled refineries. Shell is gearing up to reopen many of the Gulf pipelines that carry crude to shore in the next week, according to a person familiar with the operations. A key step to potentially restoring offshore crude output. Still, a crucial conduit for Mars oil and other grades will remain shut as damage assessments continue, the person said. The company declined to comment. Further inland, the crippling effects of the cyclone are still being assessed. A New Orleans area refinery owned by Phillips 66 suffered so much damage and flooding that the company may not even restart it, depending on how expensive it'll cost to repair. Shell's Norco refining and chemical complex north of New Orleans may remain shut for several more weeks because of extensive damage.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, September 15th. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled, World Must Wait for Extra Oil as Ida Wipes Out Hike, by James Herron, Bloomberg. The world will have to wait until October for additional oil supplies as output losses from Hurricane Ida wipe out increases from OPEC Plus, the International Energy Agency said. Consumers should have been enjoying solid gains in production as the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its allies continued their revival of idle capacity, the agency said in its monthly report. Instead, global supply fell by 540,000 barrels a day in August due to unexpected disruptions and will be flat this month. Unplanned production outages have temporarily halted an uptrend in world oil supply that began in March, but growth is set to resume in October, said the Paris-based IEA, which advises developed economies on energy policy. The supply disappointment hasn't had a big impact on prices because of bearish trends in fuel consumption. Global oil demand has been falling since July as rising COVID-19 cases prompt mobility restrictions in Asia, the IEA said. Crude has traded near $70 a barrel in New York for most of this month. World fuel consumption will contract by 310,000 barrels a day on average each month from July to September, the IEA said. Yet there are signs that the coronavirus resurgence is abating, and the agency expects a sharp rebound in demand of the 1.6 million barrels a day next month, with continued growth to the end of the year. The matching shifts in supply and demand meant this year's prevailing oil market trend, shrinking inventories, continued unabated. Fuel stockpiles in developed economies fell by 30 million barrels last month, putting them 186 million barrels below the 5-year average, according to preliminary IEA estimates. There should be hefty draws again this month, the agency said. It is only by early 2022 that supply will be high enough to allow oil stocks to be replenished, according to the report. In the meantime, strategic oil stocks from the U.S. and China may go some way to help plug the gap. Hurricane Ida, a Category 4 storm that hit the U.S. Gulf Coast on August 29th, initially shut down 1.7 million barrels a day of oil production. Weeks later, the industry is still struggling to restart many of the affected fields, and the region's crude output is expected to be down as much as 650,000 barrels a day on average this month, the IEA said. This article is entitled "Chevron Triples Spending on Low-Carbon Tech" by Kevin Crowley, Bloomberg. Chevron Corporation will triple investments in lower-carbon technologies through the next 7 years as Chief Executive Officer Mike Wirth responds to rising investor pressure on climate change. The oil giant will spend $10 billion through 2028 on hydrogen, renewable natural gas, and carbon capture, with 20% of that allocated to reducing the carbon intensity of its operations, the San Ramon, California-based company said in a statement Tuesday. Chevron's commitment to pathway to net zero falls short of plans by its competitors like BP PLC and Royal Dutch Shell PLC, which have set explicit targets to eliminate emissions by mid-century. Chevron tends to grow production of fossil fuels and has bound its climate efforts with a strategy of improving financial returns, arguing that one without the other won't work for shareholders and the environment. The approach contrasts with that of its European peers, which are planning long-term pivots towards more renewable energies over time. Our guidance paints the picture of how our traditional and new energy businesses work together to drive and sustain financial performance in a lower carbon future, Wirth said in a presentation to investors on Tuesday. Higher returns, lower carbon. We must deliver both to earn a higher valuation for our shareholders and benefit for all stakeholders. Whether or not he's right remains to be seen. A shareholder vote to replace a quarter of ExxonMobil Corporation's board with more climate-friendly directors sent shockwaves through the industry earlier this year, showing that Wall Street's biggest investors are willing to shake up boardrooms if they feel companies are failing on the environment. Chevron's board received its own wake-up call in May when investors voted against its recommendations and in favor of reducing the company's so-called Scope 3 emissions, or those from fuel and other products it makes. Chevron will respond to the shareholder vote in a report next month after consultation with the board, according to Wirth. Shares of the company fell 1.2% to $96.80 at 11:27 a.m. in New York. We are surprised that the release does not mention any longer-term net zero-related targets like some of its peers have announced recently, Biraj Borkhataria of RBC Capital Markets wrote in a note. Chevron's emissions targets are conservative, and we were expecting the company to increase its ambition. This article is entitled "OPEC Takes a More Bullish View of the Oil Market in 2022" by Julian Lee, Bloomberg. There's going to be an oil supply crunch in the summer of 2022. At least that's the latest view from the analysis of OPEC, and it stands in stark contrast to the other major forecasting agencies. The International Energy Agency, the U.S. Energy Information Administration, and the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries all increased their assessments of global oil demand growth next year. But while the increases made by the IEA and EIA were modest, the Oil Producers Group revision was anything but. OPEC analysts now see global oil demand increasing by 4.15 billion barrels a day in 2022 compared to the level expected for this year, an upward revision of 860,000 barrels a day from what they forecast a month ago. That compares with growth of 3.24 million barrels a day seen by the IEA and 3.64 million barrels by the EIA, up just fractionally from their August reports. The upward revision isn't uniform across the year, with the biggest increase, 1.33 million barrels a day, seen in the second quarter, and the smallest, 310,000 barrels a day, in the fourth. The stronger demand outlook is driven by more optimistic views on consumption levels in China, the rest of Asia, and Europe. Together, those regions account for 640,000 barrels a day, or about two-thirds of the total revision. Positive economic developments alongside containment of COVID-19 are seen boosting European demand, while solid economic growth and a healthy outlook for transportation fuels are expected to power the increases in Asia, according to OPEC's report. The evolving demand forecasts have important implications for global oil balances next year, leading to big revisions from the August forecasts of the amount of crude needed from the members of OPEC in order to balance supply and demand. There have been no corresponding upward revisions to oil production forecasts to offset the higher demand numbers. Indeed, those have moved in the opposite direction in the short term. OPEC cut its assessment of production from countries outside the group by 520,000 barrels a day in the current quarter, with half of the reduction resulting from the impact of Hurricane Ida on operations in the U.S. Gulf of Mexico. While it doesn't see that impact extending beyond September, it has made smaller downward revisions to production in Europe and Asia all the way through the end of 2022, boosting its assessment of the world's need for its members' crude by a further 150,000 barrels a day next year to fill the gap. Comparing the volumes of OPEC crude needed against the group's most recent production level for August, OPEC's bullishness stands out, particularly in the second half of next year. The producer group is scheduled to add 250,000 barrels a day to production each month under the terms of its current output deal with a group of allies. The forecasts suggest that it may have to take a pause from those increases in the first quarter of 2022, perhaps even reversing them briefly. How long that period of weakness lasts depends on whose forecasts you believe. The IEA, and to a lesser extent the EIA, see a prolonged period during which the producers will again need to exercise output restraint. The IEA pegs the world's need for OPEC crude in the second half of 2022 at just 570,000 barrels a day above last month's production level.
Other voices from the Odessa American for Sunday. Letters to the editor. A memory of September 11th. The following short account is based on my experience as a volunteer for the American Red Cross of Southwest Texas, Odessa chapter, in response to the September 11th, 2001, World Trade Center terrorist attack. During my assignment in October through November, I volunteer an extra evening for a special presentation. Families of the attack victims are expressly invited to receive an urn and an American flag. In some instances, more than one urn is presented to a single family. It is now November 2001. Our daily tasks are on hold because of a special invitation in our building. A procession is to take place, a funeral procession, that is. Trucks have arrived, delivering boxes. Cardboard boxes upon cardboard boxes are carted by hand, pushed dollies into the cavernous building that is the Red Cross New York City chapter headquarters. The large boxes, like statues, are draped with American flags. The wheels of the caissons click and clack on the sleeping floor as they spin round and round, awakening the somber, lifting them into pure solemnity. The cadence of every step taken by the bearers orchestrate a refinement of respect. The bagpipes, in unison, open and rip every moment into a silent silence. The handsome trumpets, humming a salute, send every heartbeat into clusters of loyal noise, clamoring to thump their way out into the grieving air. The magical notes, sensing such reverence, turn every brave tear into a sea of wavering banners in mourning salute. The time comes when families of the victims are to be presented with a hand-sized, purple felt-covered box as an urn, each accompanied by an American flag. Each family or individual family member is escorted to a booth for privacy so as not to interrupt any personal displays of emotions from the other booths. The city of New York has bequeathed the urns and flags as symbols of honor and respect. Within each urn is a note of condolence to be read upon presentation. I choose to present the flag because there are no words to be spoken upon presentation. If I speak, I know I will choke on my own words. I will blind my eyes with tears I am not supposed to shed. Once properly bearing the flag in my hands, its colors beseech its symbolism of honor. The stars, the vibrant, white embroidered stars, soothe their way out of the blue platform. My nervous fingers touch the red stripes to quell the noisome, flaming red cloth. I extend my hands with the folded flag, and with unrehearsed words, I relay a remembrance of the family's loss. I convey condolences from my hometown and my home state of Texas, and that quickly breaks any semblance of tension between the family and me. Like long-lost friends, we cast the moment with a short visit, embraces and a brief encounter of meaningful solitude and heartfelt mirrored affection. Martha Flores, Odessa. Leach was a good leader. Charles Cotton, Odessa, writes, I was saddened this week to learn of the passing of Dr. Dwayne Leach, former president of UTPB, and later the executive director of the John Ben Shepherd Public Leadership Institute. Under his presidency, the university became a four-year institution, but perhaps more important was his shepherding the facility through a difficult time, when the state legislature had decided to defund the university. If not for him and several local citizens, like John Ben Shepherd, the physical plant you see today might not even be there. He also was instrumental in reaching out to reconcile with Midland over the placement of the university in Odessa by getting the CEED program and building placed halfway between the two cities out by the airport. While he was president, he worked with the Texas JCs when I had the honor of being the executive vice president to host the first John Ben Shepherd Leadership Forum on the campus back in 1985. 10 years later, he would work with the JCs to get state funding for the creation of the John Ben Shepherd Public Leadership Forum that would be headquartered on the UTPB campus, with the mission from then-Lieutenant Governor Bob Bullock to bring leadership education to the four corners of Texas. At that time, there were few leadership programs in the state or nation. Today, every campus has a leadership program, with hundreds more in the business world. To date, thanks to the vision of Dr. Leach, over 50,000 young people have been introduced to concepts and practices of leadership in Texas. The Permian Basin has been blessed with the opportunity to hear and see in person dozens of the top thinkers in the country, thanks to the Distinguished Lecture Series as part of the JBS program. Dr. Leach was also part of the group that worked with former Representative Buddy West that secured the funding to build the current home of the Presidential Museum Archives on the UTPB campus. I had the honor of being the first associate director of the JBS Institute, serving with Dr. Leach. He was small in stature, but an intellectual giant. The university and the city of Odessa owe him a great deal. he will be missed.
To Your Good Health by Dr. Keith Roach. Where do COVID variants come from? Dear Dr. Roach, we know COVID-19 came from Wuhan, China. Where are the Delta and other variants coming from? Answer: COVID-19 was first described in Wuhan, China, although the exact mechanism of how the virus that causes COVID-19 came to infect humans is not known. Most authorities believe it evolved from a bat coronavirus. Viruses infect cells and tell them to start creating large number of viruses using the virus's own RNA. The mechanism to copy the RNA over and over again is not perfect, and errors, called mutations, lead to different variants of the viruses. Some of these lead to no significant change. Others have adverse results for the virus. However, a few variants have accumulated mutations that lead them to be able to spread more quickly. The variants of concern get a Greek letter designation. Currently, Alpha, also called B.1.1.7, first isolated in the UK in late 2020, and Delta, called B.1.6.1.7.2, first isolated in India in December 2020, have been found to be more transmissible. All variants, as far as we know, are viral mutants from the original Wuhan outbreak. Reducing overall infections is critical to reduce the likelihood of a more dangerous variant. Universal vaccination is the best way of achieving that. Mask and other measures reduce spread.
This is the Dear Abby column. Pandemic isolation leaves man's social skills rusty. Dear Abby, I am a guy who is 27. I have always been somewhat shy and reserved, but I do like people and I like mixing. After more than a year of being locked down during the COVID-19 pandemic, although I was fine with being housebound, I started missing human contact. Social opportunities are opening up for me now, and though I was never great in conversations at parties, my time away has made me rusty. I believe you have written some pointers for being better in social situations. Can you give me a quick refresher course? Thanks, Abby. Signed, Ready to be back out there. Dear Ready, I'm happy to try. The first thing is to understand is that social adeptness is a skill. No one is born with it. It has to be learned. With practice, it can be polished until it becomes second nature. Part of being social is showing an interest in other people. Encourage them to share their interests and opinions. Ask them to tell you about themselves and what they think. Ask their opinions, and when they tell you, be a good listener. Cultivate your own interests so you will have something to share with them. I publish a booklet, which is probably what you were alluding to in your letter, titled How to Be Popular. That contains many useful tips for polishing social skills. It can be ordered by sending your name and address, plus a check or money order for $8, U.S. funds, to Dear Abby Popularity Booklet, P.O. Box 447, Mount Morris, Illinois, 61054-0447. Shipping and handling are included in the price. It is meant for people of all ages and covers a variety of situations. If parents, teachers, and clergy know someone who needs help in this regard, it might make an inexpensive gift that could change the course of a person's life. When you receive it, don't read it just once. Keep it handy for reference because it contains many helpful suggestions about how to be kind of individual to others, be the kind of individual others find interesting and attractive. The keys to being socially successful are be kind, be honest, be tactful. Offer a compliment if you think it is deserved. And if you become anxious, remember, people can only think of one thing at a time. Forget about yourself and concentrate on the other person. Try it, and you'll find it works like a charm. Dear Abby, lately my best friend has been assuming the role of the masculine lesbian in our duo. I'm tired of making cute outfits, and I want to turn to dress as the male. How do I subtly hint that we need a role switch up? Signed, Curious and Confused in Connecticut. Dear Curious and Confused, hint. Why hint? Choose a time when you are both calm and relaxed and tell her what you need. You have a right to do that, and if she cares about you, she should be willing to accommodate you. You can write to Dear Abby at dearabby.com or P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069. Her column is distributed by Universal Press Syndicate.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.